Mexico is Arizona's biggest trading partner, and the state is interested in even more. Is that relationship dependent on transportation improvements?
To say that the trade wouldn't increase, I don't know if I would say that. I would say that you're starting to limit your options.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, what could be included in revamping the state's education funding formulas, the regulations or lack thereof in homeschooling. Several groups are watching the selection process for new game and fish commissioners, and a new documentary looks at the role Latinos played during the Vietnam War, both at home and abroad.
We're proud of what we did, but now it's time for us to show the world, the United States, the general public, we were there too.
Plus, we meet a champion of change and the sounds of ecology. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. We could see some more rain this afternoon. Otherwise, look for a high of 87. Partly cloudy tonight, 30% chance of rain. Overnight lows in the mid-70s. Partly sunny and warmer tomorrow with a high of 94. Right now in Phoenix with relative humidity of 40%, it's partly cloudy, 90 degrees at KJZZ. A group of whistleblowers says the Department of Veterans Affairs hasn't done enough to address problems with retaliation. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, that testimony was made at a Senate hearing today, which was organized to highlight the issue and encourage congressional action.
The panelists made several recommendations to the committee, including a push to fire VA employees who are found to have retaliated against a whistleblower and provide better protection of veteran medical records. Brandon Coleman is a former addiction therapist at the Phoenix VA Medical Center and a veteran himself. He testified that his medical records were illegally accessed and used against him after he raised questions about the safety measures being taken to protect suicidal veterans.
My answer is accountability. When we catch these directors doing wrongdoing, they need to be fired just like they do to us when we come forward. You know, these aren't people you're ready to run into combat with because they're out for themselves.
Representatives with the Office of Special Counsel, the Office of the Inspector General, and the VA's Chief Medical Officer were also in attendance. That panel took more heat from committee members who said the culture of retaliation against VA whistleblowers is an ongoing issue and needs to be fixed. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Attorney General's office has dismissed a complaint that accused a Department of Education employee of using his official authority to influence political action. The Coalition to Recall Diane Douglas filed the paperwork 2 weeks ago. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
An Attorney General's office investigator said in a letter Friday, based on the information provided in the complaint, the Attorney General won't initiate a criminal investigation. Max Goshard is chairman of the Coalition to Recall Diane Douglas, the group who filed the complaint.
We're thankful that the Attorney General and his team looked into it and spent their time to make sure that no laws were broken. We still believe that this action was inappropriate by Michael Bradley, and it's not appropriate for him to be attempting to intimidate any organizations.
He's referring to an email sent by Superintendent of Public Instruction Diane Douglas's Chief of Staff, Michael Bradley. He sent a note to the Arizona Alliance of Black School Educators inquiring why its website had information about the recall effort and asked if the organization intended to support it. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A panel appointed by Governor Doug Ducey to recommend changes to the state's school funding formula will be releasing some recommendations later this hour. Here to talk about what those might include is reporter Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times. And Jeremy, remind us, what is the Classrooms First initiative?
Well, the Classrooms First initiative, this is a council that Governor Ducey put together earlier in the year. It's kind of the overarching goal of kind of overhauling the state's formulas that we use to fund K-12 schools. And exactly what goes into that is still kind of up in the air, and I think a lot of folks are waiting to see exactly what recommendations and kind of what topics they're going to address here today.
Do you have any sense of what the panel might recommend as far as changes to those formulas?
Well, there's a lot of folks in the education community are waiting with bated breath to find out today. But it sounds like based on what we've heard, you can take a couple of educated guesses. The governor has talked a lot about kind of rewarding high-performing schools, so there very well could be some kind of performance funding piece in there. You know, he talked about that, at, like I believe, at the first meeting. wanting to reward performance more than just per pupil funding. Now, I don't think anyone expects any real changes to the per pupil formula or for that to go away, but there could be something, some type of performance funding piece, which would be kind of ironic because Governor Brewer did that, just a couple of years ago, or I think maybe it was last year even, and in the budget, Governor Ducey ended up sweeping the money from that for a different education proposal.
Does it seem like the changes are going to be sort of broad overhauls or like little tweaks here and there?
I think probably more little tweaks over there, here and there. Nobody's, as far as I can tell, is really expecting any sort of like major rewrite of the formula. In fact, they've only been working on this for a few months. If you're going to completely rewrite this extremely complex and complicated formula, I would imagine it was going to take longer than that. Another issue that does involve the formula that's expected to come up is funding for special ed students. The state's kind of been shorting the schools on that. It's an expensive facet of education. There may be some proposals there. And in some other areas, it may be less of a proposal as kind of an issue here where they say, hey, there's some problems with this. We need to address that somehow.
If the panel's recommended changes are, in fact, sort of minor changes, not these really large-scale type things, do you expect those still to be controversial?
Some of them could. I mean, pretty much everything involving K-12 education is controversial. And, if you talk performance funding, that's always going to be very controversial. If they recommend anything that requires more spending, that, of course, is going to be controversial.
And then, of course, you have to get it through the legislature, which in almost anything, as you say, with education and education funding, that becomes both political and controversial, right?
Oh, of course. And this, it may end up getting kind of wrapped up in a lot of other stuff. Governor Ducey has, a pretty ambitious education agenda, online for next session. You get legislative leadership that has, a few major ideas. Everyone's trying to kind of negotiate who's going to get behind what. There's some talk of a special session. It seems like the governor's office and Senate President Biggs are still kind of hashing out the details about what might actually go into that. I mean, there's so many education things going on right now. The governor's really got a lot of balls in the air, and we kind of have to wait to see how these things are all going to work together. Plus, you have the ongoing lawsuit, and the settlement talks recently fell through. There may be, we could see some moves to try and address that. I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a very education-heavy session in 2016, and this will at least give us a little bit of insight into what some of the other things in Governor Ducey's agenda might be.
So you think it's possible that whatever recommendations come out today and that the governor wants to try to adopt could get wrapped into his proposal to tap more state trust land money for education or something else?
I mean, it could be. If these things all end up as kind of part of a larger negotiation or discussion at the legislature on education funding, on education policy, these things could at all end up being kind of tied together.
Jeremy Duda is a reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, thanks as always.
All right, thanks a lot, Mark.
Transportation officials across the country have been talking about the nation's infrastructure and what it could and should look like down the road. One such conversation included the Deputy U.S. Transportation Secretary yesterday in Phoenix. In Arizona, one big issue is how our transportation system impacts the state's ability to trade with Mexico. For more on that, we turn to the Director of the Arizona Department of Transportation, John Halikoski, who was also at yesterday's forum.
It's obvious that Mexico is our number one trading partner, and all of those goods have to go back and forth between our two countries, which requires that we have the infrastructure to do so. But more importantly, it has to be done efficiently.
So what has to happen to make that a reality?
Really, what is important for both countries is relationships and good communications. If you look at what's happened in Mexico, you have quite a bit of goods being produced for the United States, but most of those goods are shipped over the Mexican highway system to Texas, and some of them wind up then being backtracked to the ports at L.A. and Long Beach. We have one highway from central Mexico that leads into Arizona. It's MX-15, and it comes right into Nogales, where it joins up with State Route 189, which then goes to I-19. So our proposition is to form close relationships with the Mexican Transportation and Communications Secretariat so that we can get the necessary improvements to MX-15 and make Arizona an attractive destination for those manufacturers in central Mexico to not only ship to us, but then utilize us for possibly finishing goods or manufacturing goods on either our side of the border or on the Mexican side, ultimately for destinations then to the West Coast.
Are there specific projects that, in your mind, need to be done in Arizona to help improve trade, increase trade?
Yes, absolutely. State Route 189 is at the top of that list. We have a vision that what we would like to do within the next 5 to 7 years is improve State Route 189 to provide a flyover, which is both a north and southbound flyover for traffic, and do some safety improvements along the roadway, the 4 miles that leads into Mexico. So we've been working closely on State Route 189, but we also have to look very closely at our 1970s freeways, I-19 and I-10, which serve as vital economic links to markets elsewhere.
So are you imagining that the state will be paying for this as opposed to federal sources?
Well, what I would imagine is that we will bring all of our resources to bear. Some of those will be federal. Some of them we will have to generate, I believe, here as state.
If the money is then going to come, at least in part, from the state, from where do you think it'll come?
Well, what we are really concerned about is that it's not so much where it will come from, but what will the voters support? Traditionally, transportation has been funded by gasoline taxes, but as we look at new investment, gasoline taxes are not the workhorse that they used to be. So as we move forward, we have to decide what kind of funding matrix fits for Arizona, and that may be gasoline tax in part, but it may be a combination of other revenue sources as well.
In your mind, is it fair to say that if transportation and transportation infrastructure doesn't improve, the state's trade with Mexico will not increase?
So what we're talking about there is a do-nothing alternative. To say that the trade wouldn't increase, I don't know if I would say that. I would say that you're starting to limit your options. You have a port at Nogales, which the federal government recently invested $250 million in to make that into a modern port. It can handle more traffic than is moving through now, but you have to have somewhere for those trucks to go. And if we do nothing, then our interstate system, state highway system, does not only not get expanded and modernized to handle modern communications and traffic, but then it becomes a maintenance issue.
John Helikoski is director of the Arizona Department of Transportation. The Arizona Department of Public Safety says its investigation continues into a series of freeway shooting incidents along I-10 in Phoenix. Even after the arrest of a man late last week, officials say is tied to 4 of the shootings. KJZZ's Phil Latzman has been following the investigation and joins me with more details. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Mark. And as you may remember, late Friday, 21-year-old Leslie Allen Merritt Jr. of Glendale was arrested at a Walmart and accused of being the man who pulled the trigger in the first 4 incidents dating back to August 29th.
This news was reported pretty widely, not just on news outlets but KJZZ, but also from some unlikely sources.
Right. In fact, so confident in the police work, even Governor Doug Ducey tweeted, quote, "We got him."
So what's happened since?
The landscaper made his first appearance in court on Saturday. In a brief statement, he told the judge that authorities had the wrong guy. His father, Leslie Merritt Sr., even made an emotional appeal to the media to proclaim his son's innocence. Authorities have linked the shell casings and the bullet fragments to Merritt's gun, yet he claims the weapon was in the pawn shop at the time of the shootings. He's been charged with aggravated assault, criminal damage, and intentional acts of terrorism.
But he's only been connected to 4 of the 11 incidents DPS has linked together, yes?
Yeah, that's right. And those freeway signs asking for tips and that $50,000 reward remains in place. Michael Picaretta is a former president of the Arizona Bar. He's adjunct professor at UA in Tucson and a longtime criminal defense attorney. I was curious about his opinion on how the case has been handled so far.
what struck me about this case was his assertions of innocence in court, which, first of all, any lawyer with him would not be too happy that he's making any public statements regarding guilt or innocence. So that was not the time or place for them. Secondly, whenever there is a high-profile crime, there is always pressure on law enforcement to solve it as quickly as possible. And they have to be immune to let the case take its course, because whenever there's pressure to wrap up a case, that's when you're more likely to have mistakes made in the investigation on it, because you need it just to calm the public down. Now, I am not saying that's what occurred. I'm just saying that's the nature of those type of cases.
So was it advisable for the governor, Doug Ducey, to tweet on Friday night, "We got him"? Is that an example of the political pressure you're talking about to catch this guy?
Well, that's an example of it, but it's also an example of someone who's really not versed in the criminal justice system. Elected officials, other than to announce the arrest and announce the charges and to make statements to make sure the public knows that someone has been arrested, their job is not to make conclusive comments, because neither Governor Ducey nor anyone else knows whether they got him. They know they've arrested somebody, and now the evidence will get tested. So I think it's really, I don't think it was done maliciously. It's just a mark of someone who's not well-versed in the criminal justice system.
But as a criminal defense attorney, you might be able to point to that and say, hey, the political pressure may be leading to this rush to judgment.
Well, there's undoubtedly political pressure, and it's undoubtedly, you know, not the smartest thing that the governor should be announcing. But again, you know, it does point out to his interest in the case. It does point out his conclusion that that is the guy, when in actuality, even though he's been arrested, he's presumed innocent.
So, Mr. Picaretta, what have the police done right, in your opinion, and what have they done wrong in this ongoing investigation?
Well, it's hard for me to comment on really either of those until you actually review all of the reports. But I'm presuming they worked hard. They found something that connected this gentleman to the crime they've alleged. So, in general, that's a good thing if they catch him. In terms of whether they got the right person or what they did right or what they did wrong, it's a little premature and certainly not my province, without studying the evidence, to comment on it. However, I think that you have to be very careful whenever you arrest anyone to start twisting your arm by patting yourself on the back. You've arrested someone, the process begins, you've brought the charges, and now we'll see if it holds up. So it's premature to have a victory lap or even to announce one, and particularly premature to announce conclusively that they caught the person. I think that it's proper to announce the arrest, and then at that point it gets turned over to prosecutors, courts, and lawyers for the accused to determine whether the evidence is strong enough. And in the end run, ultimately the judge and the jury will decide what they've done right and what they've done wrong.
Mike Picaretta is a criminal defense attorney and former president of the Arizona Bar. Sir, thanks very much for your time.
Sure. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Still ahead this hour, picking a new commissioner is tougher than it seems.
Wildlife in Arizona is multifaceted, you know, and we need to be cognizant of that issue when making these type of decisions.
The process of selection in 10 minutes on the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
Those big, puffy clouds, kind of whitish-grayish clouds, should stick around for at least the rest of the day. Could produce some rain before it's all over. Look for a high of 87. 98, by the way, is the average high for today. Partly cloudy skies again for tonight. 30% chance of showers. Overnight lows in the mid-70s. Partly sunny and warmer tomorrow with a high of 94. Right now in Phoenix, under partly cloudy skies, 90 degrees at KJZZ at 223.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center, showcasing the National Circus and Acrobats of the People's Republic of China on Thursday, October 1st, juggling aerial silk tricks and more. Tickets and pre-show dinner packages at mesaartscenter.com.
A recent investigation published in ProPublica and Slate looks at the relative lack of regulation of families that homeschool their kids. The piece was written by Jessica Hoseman, a fellow at the Teacher Project at the Columbia Journalism School.
There are only two states that really strongly regulate homeschooling, and that's New York and Pennsylvania. The vast majority of states are not consistent in the way that they regulate homeschooling at all. So, for example, a lot of states have required subject matter for homeschooled students, as in it's written into law that if a child is going to be homeschooled or if they're going to be pulled out of public school, they have to learn math, they have to learn how to read and write, they have to learn science, et cetera, et cetera. But very few states ever actually test this material. So while they require students to learn it by law, they never actually verify that parents are following the law. And that's a trend that you see across the country. So even what few regulations homeschooled families do have are very rarely enforced.
What did you find about why it is that states, including Arizona, that have regulations for what students learn in homeschool, and then the state never really checks to make sure it's happening?
You know, I think that the Homeschool Legal Defense Association is a huge reason why so little regulation exists. They've been very effective in rolling back regulation that existed at one time and now no longer exists. And Arizona is actually a perfect example of this. So in the mid-80s, when homeschooling became legal in Arizona, it was regulated. Homeschooled students were required to pass tests every year. They also had standards for what would happen if there were concerns about a child not being well educated. In 1993, the legislature removed that requirement. And in 1995, the legislature removed all testing requirements from the homeschool law whatsoever. So at that point, the only regulation in Arizona was that within 30 days of first beginning to homeschool, the parent had to notify the state that their child was being homeschooled.
Is the concern with the lack of regulation that kids aren't getting a good education, that parents aren't qualified to be teaching the subjects, that there's something maybe more sinister or criminal going on with these kids?
So I think that there are concerns across the board in all of the issues that you just raised. It's certainly not the case that a majority or even a large minority of parents who homeschool are abusing their children in any way or are offering them a poor education. The concern is that because the regulations are so lax, it provides an opportunity for parents who would abuse their children to do so without being caught.
Jessica Hoseman is a fellow at the Teacher Project at the Columbia Journalism School and wrote the article for ProPublica and Slate on the lack of homeschool regulation. She referenced the rules in Arizona. Sylvia Miller has some experience with them. The mother of four homeschools her three kids who are school age. They're in first, fourth, and sixth grades. This is her seventh year of homeschooling. The Phoenix resident is also part of the group Home Educators of Central Phoenix.
I was a homeschool kid for a few years back in the mid-80s. So it had always been an option that was on the table. But when my youngest was getting ready to start kindergarten, we looked at all the options, public, charter, private, and I was already at home with my younger children. And for us, for our family, we really wanted to do a faith-based education but could not afford a private school. And so I decided that I would test the waters with kindergarten and see how it went, and haven't looked back since.
How do you decide what the curriculum is going to be? How do you make sure that you are as up on what you're teaching your kids as you need to be?
Well, in our family, we use what would be called a boxed curriculum that kind of has all the lesson plans put together and suggestions for, you know, age-appropriate math and language arts. You don't have to do it that way. Parents that are nervous about their children not meeting whatever standards, there are lots of resources available on what should your child know by the end of third grade, by the end of fourth grade. And we, about every other year, do a standardized test for our kids. So my two older children will take the Iowa Basic Skills Test in the spring, just so that I have the peace of mind knowing that they're improving, and if there's any areas that maybe they come up deficient, that I know I need to really work on that.
So when you first decided to homeschool your kids, what was the process like with the state to make sure that you could do that?
Well, Arizona has, in my opinion, a really well-balanced approach to homeschooling in which you have to file an affidavit. So you are required to school children from 6 to 16. When your child turns 6, you have to report with the Department of Education that you're choosing to homeschool, and you provide a birth certificate, and you sign an agreement that you will teach at least minimum subjects, reading, grammar, social studies, math, and science.
Does anybody ever check to make sure you are teaching those subjects?
I don't know what the Department of Education does as far as internally. I have never been contacted to confirm that I am doing that.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah, because I am doing that. I mean, I had to, on penalty of perjury, promise that I was going to. And not only that, it's really important to me that my kids get a good education. I wouldn't be doing this if I thought I couldn't adequately give them one.
It sounds like the amount of oversight and regulation that Arizona has for homeschooling parents and for their students is in your mind, about right. Am I right about that?
Right. I would agree with that.
Are there any instances in which you can imagine that anything else would be a good thing for the state to do, be it check in with parents every so often to make sure that they are teaching, or require some kind of assessment or a portfolio kind of thing for somebody to look at, or to run background checks, things like that, on parents who are homeschooling their kids?
Well, in my opinion, any sort of those kind of regulations put a burden on the people who are already doing it right. Those people that are choosing to use homeschool as a cover for just not schooling their children probably aren't following the rules that are the minimal rules that are already there. And so adding further regulations doesn't mean that it's going to catch the wrongdoers. It would just put more work onto those of us that are already working hard and making the sacrifices to teach our children at home.
Sylvia Miller of Phoenix is the mother of four. She homeschools her three school-age kids who are in first, fourth, and sixth grades. The governor's office is seeking a new commissioner for the state's main wildlife regulatory body. The Arizona Game and Fish Commission makes policies for a wide range of activities in Arizona, from hunting and fishing to some law enforcement and boating. And as KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, with that much authority, several organizations are closely watching the process.
The new commissioner will be taking over for Robert Mansell, whose five-year term ends this year. According to the governor's office, qualified candidates will be someone who is well-informed and passionate about Arizona wildlife. So, what's involved with the application process? The digital application form is on the governor's website. It asks a few basic employment and identification questions and requires a resume for successful completion. Ducey spokesman Daniel Ruiz adds there are a few restrictions to keep in mind.
So we have representation from all 15 counties. And so for this application, folks that aren't able to apply are residents of Apache, Coconino, Maricopa, or Yuma.
The state also has limits on how many of the commission's members can belong to a certain political party. However, this time, that's not a factor. The deadline is October 7th. After that, Ruiz explains the next step for candidates is the commission's appointment recommendation board.
and they will have the opportunity to interview the applicants and narrow it down to at least two and no more than five folks who the governor can consider appointing.
It may sound simple, but the process is a big deal for many organizations.
Wildlife in Arizona is multifaceted, as are the people that support the wildlife. You know, and we need to be cognizant of that issue when making these type of decisions.
Stephen Clark is the executive director of the Arizona Elk Society. He says when the application window opens, his group does their best to spread the word through social media and email blasts.
Not only we can try to reach out to somebody that might want to put in for the position, but we can also monitor the people that are putting in to see if there's a big push towards one side or another.
The Sierra Club's Sandy Barr says her organization will also be closely watching this process and encouraging many of their members to apply. But she says lately it's been hard to get too excited about the whole process.
When we ask someone to apply, we have to tell them that it's a long shot. Now it seems like it's really hard to even get an interview with the current recommendation board.
Barr takes issue with the recommendation board, which is a relatively new addition to the selection process. It was created by the Arizona legislature in 2010, and supporters argue it's a good way to pare down the number of candidates. Jim Unmacht is the president of Arizona Sportsmen for Wildlife Conservation.
To have a review board go through those and find a few that are more qualified than the others, we think is a good thing.
The Sierra Club also contends that what the board is looking for isn't very transparent, but Governor Ducey's office disagrees. Spokesman Daniel Ruiz points out before any decisions are made, the board hosts a public forum to get a better feel for the issues Arizonans are concerned about. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Coming up, a mentorship program designed specifically for Native American students.
When you see a Native college student in college that looks like them, that probably listens to the same music they do, then it makes them feel like, okay, you know, that we got some amazing, smart, talented students going to college. I'm smart too, and I can see myself doing that as well.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on 91.5 KJZZ. Maybe you're online this afternoon, kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Look for the possibility of some rain this afternoon. It certainly is at least partly cloudy right now. We're looking for a forecast high of 87 degrees. We hit 92 yesterday. 98 is average. Partly cloudy tonight, 30% chance of rain. Overnight lows in the mid to upper 70s. Partly sunny and warmer tomorrow, the high of 94, back up to the triple digits, potentially by Thursday. It's 90 degrees right now at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by Corporation for Public Broadcasting, presenting the new PBS documentary, On Two Fronts, Latinos in Vietnam, airs tonight at 10 p.m. on Arizona PBS.
In the news from KJZZ, the Peoria Police Department is one of four Valley agencies receiving federal grant money for body cameras, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona announced today. Peoria was one of the first West Valley agencies to use body cameras when its program began in December of 2014. The department outfitted patrol, traffic, and canine officers with 54 body cameras. They're from Scottsdale-based Taser International. The department hoped to increase that number this year. Peoria Police Commander Douglas Steele says the grant money will double the number of officers wearing cameras.
Absolutely. I've gotten multiple requests from officers asking, hey, when are we going to expand the program? When am I going to be able to get a camera? But overall, the program has been very, very positive.
The Phoenix, Glendale, and Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community Police Departments were also awarded money for body cameras. The grants are worth about $1.3 million combined. The White House recently recognized its champions of change, individuals it believes are doing extraordinary things in their communities. Amanda Tacchini was one of two people from Arizona honored. It was for her work with an organization called Native SOAR, a mentorship program for Native American students. She starts by introducing herself in Navajo.
Yat e she Amanda Tacchini inishye, nanish eja Tacchini inishlo, ezislana bashish chin, tkabahan dashiche anshihia dashanele, luk antia nasha. My name is Amanda Tacchini, and I introduce myself to you in Navajo. That's the way I was brought up, to always introduce yourself and it identifies myself and my relationship to my family. And so I'm originally from Ganado, Arizona, and I currently work at Arizona State University as a postdoctoral scholar. So what I study is Native students in college.
So you were just at the White House. You were honored as a champion of change. And you were there for your work with a program that mentors Native American high school and college students. What is that program about?
Yes, I worked with a program called Native SOAR, Student Outreach, Access, and Resiliency. And it's based out of University of Arizona in Tucson. And the program is a two-tiered mentoring program where Native professionals, mostly faculty and grad students, mentor predominantly Native undergrad students who are going to school at U at the U of A. And then those students in turn mentor Native American high school students in the Tucson as well as in the tribal communities, predominantly Dona Otham Nation and the Pascua-Yaqui Nation. And so the mentoring is all guided on this idea of increasing college attainment of Native people.
What kind of a role does that kind of mentoring play as far as getting Native American kids through high school and into college and through college?
I feel like it plays a powerful role because too oftentimes you don't see many Native peoples going to college. One, because we're so few and far between in terms of a small representation. We're often termed as the invisible population because our population is so small in comparison to the larger population. And so our Native high school students, what I hear from them is that knowing that there is a Native mentor that's undergrad, it makes it possible for them that they can also do that because they see themselves in the undergrad students. And then for the undergrad students, for them to mentor the Native high school students, they share with me that it makes them feel like they need to be stronger in their academics. And so it motivates them to also do well, which is important because we also need to increase our Native college students' persistence. And so when I say a powerful role, I mean that it really provides an opportunity for our Native students to see that it's possible that they can get a college degree too.
So in some ways, is it really a sort of a change in perception both among the high school students and the college students and how they look at themselves and how they look at their situation?
I think so, because as you probably already know, that the dominant framework or perception of Native people is often from a stereotypical lens. You know, Natives are often considered in pop culture right now popular in the woman wearing headdresses on Victoria's Secret models or mascots and the negative imagery from there, or even in the historical lens that we're seeing from a historical standpoint only and therefore obsolete and no longer a part of the American fabric. And so when you see a Native college student in college that looks like them, that probably listens to the same music they do, you know, that has the same passions, then it makes them feel like, okay, you know, that this is here as well. And so it puts an empowering perspective for our Native students. Like, yeah, you know what? We got some amazing, smart, talented students going to college. I'm smart too, and I can see myself doing that as well.
What are some of the things that you had to tailor specifically to Native populations?
One of the main things we included is the element of family. Research states how family is so pivotal for our Native students in educational attainment, their support. And so oftentimes these outreach programs, they do not include the family aspect. It's usually just the student. And so we include family in our programming, meaning that when we have on-campus visits as part of the Native SOAR program, so Native students come on campus for a day and they have workshops, but we include in that as family in that discussion. All family are welcome to come. One topic was about, you know, how to navigate being away from your culture and your home in college and how to find strength in your culture and your spirituality and your faith and your teachings through that process. And so things like that is what we tailor is specific cultural pieces.
Amanda Tacchini is recently back from the White House. She was honored as a champion for change for her work with Native SOAR, a mentorship program that involves Native American high school and college students. Amanda, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
A new documentary premieres tonight on PBS that looks at the Latino experience during the Vietnam War, both on the front lines and in this country.
In my parents' generation, they all served. There was a lot of gratitude for the opportunities that we had here in this country because my parents were born here, but my grandparents came here from Mexico.
On Two Fronts looks at the soldiers and their families during the war. Here to talk about it is filmmaker Milen Moreno, who produced the documentary, and Oscar Urrea, a first-generation American who served as a radio operator in Vietnam and now works as a veterans advocate and artist. Milen, what led you to make this film?
I'm often drawn to stories that reflect my own cultural background. I'm the children of two immigrants. My mother's from Canada, and my father is from Mexico. So many of my projects have delved into my heritage.
Did you find that this particular conflict had a different impact on the Hispanic community than it did on other communities?
You know, honestly, there's no real data that isolates Latinos from the rest of working class kids that were serving in Vietnam. So we never made any claims that there was anything unique about the way kids were pulled into war for Latinos, but there was a lot of information about the disproportionate burden that working class kids bore in that war.
Oscar, when you were serving, the other members of your troop, were they Hispanic? Were they white? What was their ethnicity?
Our platoon was pretty much split in half, you know, half Latino, black, and then the others white, yeah.
Did everybody seem to get along okay? I mean, were there problems?
We had no problems when we were out in the field, you know, on search and destroy missions and stuff. We were a pretty tight unit, platoon.
Did you find that your family back home had a different experience than others based on your time there and sort of everything else that was going on in this country at that time?
Well, where I come from in Morenci, Arizona, I mean, we're a very tightly knit community. And the word patriotism is, I mean, echoes back then and even to this day. I mean, you know, we're very patriotic. So as far as family, the unity we had and the bondness is like, if you have to go, you're going, you know, serve your country.
Was there any thought in your mind that you shouldn't go or didn't want to go?
No, I had no thought whatsoever.
Milen, did you get the sense that there was a difference in the anti-war movement at home, back in this country? Was it different within the Hispanic community as opposed to the non-Hispanic community?
I think what I find as a documentarian when I start doing my research is that the stories of Latinos aren't necessarily as well documented as they are of other communities. I mean, there's a real binary sense of what civil rights means in this country. It's a black and white issue. But during the late 60s and throughout the 70s, after World War II, in fact, Latinos have come home from war and started expecting to be treated with the full equality that they served on the battlefield. When I began researching the Vietnam era, I found that there were actually several mobilizations against the war. There were other groups that were supporting the war. It was the Latino community was just as diverse as the rest of the country was in terms of supporting or opposing the war.
Milen, what do you hope that people who see this documentary will learn from it, take away from it?
I hope that the public will watch this movie and have a better understanding of what it was like to be a veteran of that war. I think that there isn't a veteran I've spoken to that isn't still experiencing that war on some level. And just having a better understanding of what that was and how it remains is, I think it would be a very important takeaway.
Do you think that in some way, Oscar, a documentary like this will raise the awareness perhaps of folks like yourself who served and maybe the stories that haven't been told up until now or maybe haven't been told as much up until now?
I honestly think that on this documentary and us talking here on radio as well, that people will start reflecting on not just, I mean, you see a lot of movies that are made and it's always showing the other folks, you know, the white folks, like they did it all. But in our culture, you know, we're more laid back, kind of quiet. We're proud of what we did, but now it's time for us to show the world, the United States, the general public, we were there too.
One of the things that was important to me in making this film was to honor the mothers and the families that remained also and the impact the war had on them. And it was a very deep impact. There was one survey of families in Santa Barbara, California, in a very Mexicano neighborhood. And it was very impressive to me to understand that despite this very long history of service in our communities, it was the mothers that were questioning policy more than anybody else, and it was the mothers that were Spanish-speaking that were questioning policy even more. So I think it's really interesting that we take for granted that there was sort of a passivity within our communities, but no, there was also a real engagement as, in terms of policy and what they were sending their sons to do.
Milen Moreno is a filmmaker and producer of On Two Fronts. We also heard from Vietnam veteran Oscar Urrea. The documentary premieres tonight at 9 o'clock on KAET Channel 8. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Well, very close to home, we could see some more rain across the valley this afternoon with a high of 87 degrees, 30% chance of showers tonight, overnight lows in the mid to upper 70s. Partly sunny, warming up tomorrow, should be drying out as well with a high of 94. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 40%, it's 90 degrees at 251.
KJZZ is supported by Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust, announcing and celebrating its 2015 Encore Career Prize Awardee, November 5th at Tempe Center for the Arts. Reservations at pipertrust.org/RSVP.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. International cooperation on challenges like global warming require a common understanding and appreciation of the changing planet in a language everyone can understand. Pictures of stranded polar bears and flooded Pacific islands, satellite pictures of shrinking glaciers and vanishing ice can sharpen and clarify the urgency of the problem for all to see. But sometimes sound is worth a million pictures in telling the story of a changing planet.
This roar is from a newsreel made back in the 1930s, and it's all that's left of what was once the largest waterfall in North America, Celilo Falls on the mighty Columbia River. It went silent in 1957 when it was submerged by the rising waters behind the Dalles Dam. That silence symbolized the obliteration of a gathering place for Native Americans that was a center of fishing, culture, and cooperation for thousands of years. A sound and a people gone. Bernie Krause recorded this soundscape of a habitat that may soon disappear. He's invented the field of soundscape ecology to tell the story and sound of a changing planet, a symphony, he says, being silenced as sounds, like players in a grand orchestra, vanish from the wild.
In 1983, I was on this mission for the California Academy of Sciences to record in Kenya, and I had picked a time of year to record in Africa that I thought was going to be very rich with sound. And it didn't really occur to me that seasons played an important role, because most of the recordings that have been done to that point were single species recordings. So we went out and we kind of deconstructed the natural world in an abstract way. And our missions always were, as ornithologists, to go out and record and separate out these individual sounds so we could have the numbers and put them in our archives. Well, when I first started working on this in 1968, what I thought was that there was much more information in the complete recordings rather than just individual birds or mammals or insects. So that's how I got into this, and that's how I began to hear it.
And as you travel around the world, and I've traveled around the world, it's striking the differences in what you hear at night when nobody's talking and when you walk outside or when you're in a tent just listening to crickets in one season, the winter silence, the howling of coyotes. What do these soundscapes mean to you?
Most recently, the thesis that we've come up with is that these sounds occur, particularly where we live, for instance. I live in an area that's a temperate zone, and this is actually the beginning of the year. This is the beginning of Darwin's timeline of evolution, if you want. This time of year, we hear just insects, crickets and insects. That's all we hear at night. And around December, after the rains are established, when it's a normal season, of course, we begin to hear frogs. So we hear the insects first, and then we hear the amphibians and reptiles. And then in February or March, we hear the birds, come into the chorus. And then we hear, finally, the mammals, the coyotes, the foxes, and different critters that are wild and vocalized around here. So it follows exactly that timeline of evolution, and it's incredible how it works out.
And the stories of your soundscapes over time tell some fairly provocative stories of humanity's impact on the world. I want to play this minute-long set of clips that you recorded in the same place. Tell me about the place where you decided to record this, Sugarloaf State Park.
Sugarloaf State Park is about a 20-minute drive from where my wife and I live, and I've been recording there since 1993. So we've seen the changes over time. And this recording, it's a spring soundscape, a dawn chorus at sunrise when the birds are their most active in the spring. This is the first one recorded in 2004.
Beautiful.
And the second in 2009, 5 years later. And the bird density is beginning to drop off at this point, partly because of global warming, we think. And here's 2014, 3 years into the drought.
Wow.
Wait. And 2015.
It started? I'm listening to it?
Yeah.
It's like... It's like silence.
No bird song.
Very little.
Silent spring. It's silent springtime.
What does that tell you?
Well, I mean, it tells me that these critters are under a lot of stress. I mean, we have a bird feeder outside of our house, and we have a lot of birds showing up, but there hasn't been a peep coming from them, not a single sound coming from these birds.
Tell me about some other places that you've collected for your various collections. I'm thinking particularly of your sound collections from Sumatra.
Well, Sumatra is important because when we recorded there in the early 90s, we really captured a lot of Aceh province. Aceh province, if you remember, was the site of the 2004 tsunami. And it wiped out a lot of the coastal area. But the people had to rebuild their houses. So they went back up into the forest, and they began to cut down the trees to rebuild their houses and also to use the wood for firewood. Well, those forests were protected. They were part of an area that orangutans still lived and the clouded leopard and so on. When I recorded there, I actually captured the soundscape when it was quite alive. I haven't been back to get the result since people have begun to change that habitat. But I have to tell you that those that we have recorded, both in Costa Rica and also in the Sierra Nevada mountains, not too far from San Francisco, where we have had before and after examples of habitats changing, the changes are radical, even when we were doing just selective logging.
That's the sound of the Osa Peninsula in Costa Rica before and after logging in the late 1980s. Bernie Krause, have we lost our connection to the soundscapes in our urban 21st century life?
My impression of it is that we're kind of being screamed at by the sounds of the natural world to slow up a little bit and take a deep breath and stop utilizing and plundering these resources that are so fragile. And we've got to start thinking about how we're doing that.
Bernie Krause, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome, John.
Bernie Krause is the founder of the field of soundscape ecology. His new book, Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes, came out last month.
That's John Hockenberry from The Takeaway.
I'm joined in studio now by Steve Goldstein, my friend and colleague, host of this program, as well as KJZZ's Here and Now.
Nothing makes me prouder than hearing that from you, Mark.
Well, that's kind
you.
Of you to say. So a pretty big show tomorrow. Lots of legal stuff going on tomorrow.
Yes, and hopefully, even if you don't like lawyers, you will tune in. We'll have a live in-studio appearance by Justice Rebecca White Birch of the Arizona Supreme Court. She's retiring as of next week. And also, if that's not enough, Linda Hirschman, the author of a new book about justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
So not just lawyers, but actually judges/justices. And that's a pretty big deal.
You've had a pretty huge impact, yeah.
Also, you'll be having some education talk tomorrow.
You, of course, had Jeremy Duda on from the Capital Times to talk about the Classrooms First initiative and some of the recommendations or lack thereof. We'll have a couple of guests on to talk about that as well.
That's KJZZ's Here and Now tomorrow morning at 11. Steve, thank you as always.
Thank you, Mark.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, executive producer John Hoban. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD, a service of Rio Salado College. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great afternoon. It's 3 o'clock.